This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's Friday, and it's been a big week in the news, starting with the terror attacks in Paris that claimed the lives of more than 120 last Friday. Well, this week, French President François Hollande told the country's parliament that France is at war against ISIS.
Ladies and gentlemen, members of the government, parliamentarians,
La France est en guerre.
France is at war.
Les actes commis vendredi soir à Paris et près du Stade de France sont des actes de guerre.
Friday evening, these are
Ils ont fait
acts
au moins
of war.
Since the attacks, French police have conducted almost 800 raids and detained some 90 people. Officials say the leader of the attacks, Abdelhamid Aboud, was killed in a raid on Wednesday.
And at the G20 in Turkey, President Obama compared the attacks to what we saw here in Boston in 2013.
We've seen the possibility of terrorist attacks on our soil. There was the Boston Marathon bombers. Obviously, it did not result in the scale of death that we saw in Paris, but that was a serious attempt at killing a lot of people by two brothers and a crock pot. And it gives you some sense of, I think, the kinds of challenges that are going to be involved in this going forward.
Indeed, many challenges going forward, along with the news just today of another attack in Mali, where gunmen stormed a hotel and took many hostages, killing at least 18.
To break all of this down, let's turn now to our Week in Review panel. Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe and a writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Hi, Renee.
How are you?
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a writer for Politico, WBUR's Cognoscenti, and The Globe as well. Tom, good to have you back.
Pleasure to be here.
So first of all, let's just get a sense from both of you about, you know, the week that has been in Paris and the question of security and the attacks and terrorism there. Just your reactions and reflections. Renee, let's start with you.
Well, you know, the situation is tragic. Many of us are in love with Paris. Many Americans love the city. And for those of us who do it, for all people, we are heartbroken. I will say that I think what's important now is not to make things worse. And I'm not sure that all of this casus belli, we're at war talk, is really helpful and could have the effect of really elevating what is just a sort of thuggish act of terrorism into some sort of grander patriotic cause, you know, and dignifies the attacks in a way that I'm not sure is helpful.
Mm. Tom, your thoughts?
It's a week I hope we don't have to repeat, and unfortunately it's a week I fear we might someday be repeating. I think I probably agree with Renee in terms of elevating this to the act of war, but I think it's also important to understand just how symbolic these attacks are, that in fact what's going on is the terrorists are deliberately seizing upon tactics that are designed to truly intimidate the normal life of a community. You know, you saw that the Boston Marathon, it wasn't just a day where people are out, it was the marathon, sort of the cultural heart of the city. And I think also in terms of Paris, the whole idea that one goes out on a Friday night, enjoys oneself,
cafe,
and relaxes,
yeah. Mm.
And this is designed to kind of undercut that kind of life. And I fear that that's we're going to be seeing a lot of that in the future.
Well, before we get more specifically to the issue of how this is all playing out vis-a-vis refugees, I did want to play a piece of tape from a conversation we had a little earlier this week, and that was with Adil Najam. He's the dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. And he said that, you know, there's another way in which the impact of what's happening in Paris is sort of washing ashore here, and that's amongst the lives and concerns of American Muslims.
You know who's most scared in Boston today? Muslims who live in Boston, the mosque I go to. People are scared of two things. One, what is the backlash going to be on me? The only thing they're scared more of, they understand it's their kids. Hmm. They're scared of ISIS. So in a way, they're scared on both sides. So I think it is happening.
So, Najam, getting right there to this question of the vulnerability that Muslim American families feel because of the social media outreach and the digital outreach that ISIS seems to be quite good at it. It's a big part of the story of what happened in Paris. Your thoughts there, Renee?
Well, I just think I don't want to repeat myself, but I do think that again, dignifying and elevating these attacks to the sense of a, you know, a global war on civilization only plays into the hands of the terrorists who want to be able to recruit young Muslim men into some sort of holy war. And I think that if we treat it more like, you know, a crime, which it is, and unleash the criminal justice, you know, international criminal justice system on these terrorists, I think we may end up having the same effect and not making the situation, you know, widening the gyre even worse.
Mm. Tom?
So Donald Trump just, I think, yesterday has now proposed that we need to register Muslims. Mandatory registration. And it really does remind you of other incredibly tragic episodes in our history, such as when we put the Japanese in internment camps in World War II. And I think that that might be, certainly there's a piece of politics that's moving in that direction. And, you know, if it was just some crackpot way off, you know, to the right or left, you would ignore it. But right now, Donald Trump is in the top of the polls. And this and very well could be the nominee for president. And this is the kind of stuff he's proposing. Yeah, I think if I were of the Muslim faith, I would be very, very worried.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the internment camps, the Japanese internment camps. And did we learn or did we not learn from history and all of that, especially because we are now up to more than half of the nation's governors suggesting that perhaps something be done about Syrian refugees. Their proposals vary. Some outright want to ban allowing any Syrian refugees into this country because of what happened in Paris, and others are taking a more measured approach, like Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, who is saying, well, I want to know more about how these refugees are vetted before I say yes or no as to whether I think they should be allowed in the country. He actually was asked this by reporters earlier this week. Let's listen to what he had to say.
No, I'm not interested in accepting refugees from Syria. I would need to know a lot more than I know now before I would agree to do anything.
And then, of course, we heard from Congressman Seth Moulton. He tweeted, quote, "It's a shame that Governor Baker doesn't know the difference between refugees and those from whom they need refuge." Also on MSNBC's Hardball yesterday, Moulton talked about integrating refugees into American communities. This is what he said.
It's actually not that hard. All we need to do is uphold our values and show the world that our values apply to all. And we're not going to make caveats for Muslims or Syrians or whatnot. We need to uphold the values that make us strong and are opposed to the values that ISIS is trying to defeat us with.
So, Renee, are you surprised by this debate over Syrian refugees and what's happened?
No, I'm not surprised, and I can understand the impulse to want to respond in a way that seems like we're trying to keep Americans safe, or in Governor Baker's case, Massachusetts residents safe. But, you know, both the Constitution and federal law are very clear that the states do not have the authority to pick and choose among immigrants or refugees to this country. This is a federal issue. So Governor Baker, I have to say, you know, he's saying that he wants to be sure that there's a good vetting process and he wants to know a lot more before he'll allow, you know, he'll agree to Syrian refugees coming through Massachusetts. But he didn't take advantage of the with 33 other governors of a conference call that was held on Tuesday night with the FBI and Homeland Security and the State Department to explain precisely what the vetting process is. As I understand it, he sent Karen Pulido, the lieutenant governor, instead. So, you know, there is a process in place, and, you know, the governor can avail himself to find out what it is. I just think that it's, you know, it's deeply offensive to our values to be, you know, putting up walls against a particular class of people or race or religion or group of people over the actions of a few. It's just not our way.
Can I just jump in here for a second, Deb? Because, you know, what was interesting to me is that at the risk of stating the obvious, unlike Europe, where tens of thousands of refugees are literally coming ashore or crossing borders there, and they do have camps to try to figure out who's going to go where, that's not happening here in the United States. The refugees who are coming here are waiting 12, 18, 24 months before they can come to the United States. So, again, I don't know specifically what the details of the vetting process is, but there is a process in place.
There is a process in place, and that's been the argument. And that's why this is an interesting debate. And is it, why is Charlie Baker sort of wading into this if it's largely symbolic? And then, of course, Congressman Moulton sending some very pointed tweets, really being one of the few people who is actually seems to be willing to speak out against the governor. What do you think of that? I mean, some folks are saying, is this a possible 2018 gubernatorial race? Is it way too early to say something? What do you think, Tom?
Well, I think sometimes it seems like there's two Charlie Bakers. There's the bad Charlie Baker and the good Charlie Baker. 4 years ago when he ran against Deval Patrick, it was the bad Charlie Baker, the angry man, the kind of automatic right-wing, let's go litmus test issues. And then, you know, when he ran most recently, it was the very different, tolerant, open, kind-hearted Charlie Baker. And he has gotten incredible reviews under the first year of his governorship in terms of how he has handled himself. This seemed a reversion to bad Charlie Baker. I hope that he really rethinks this comment because you're exactly right. It is symbolic. We don't have this as a present issue. In fact, if he had done some simple check-in, he would have found that the process by which one gets into the United States is very, very strict. If he felt that it was not strict enough, if he felt there were some tweaks that needed to be done, by all means, do that. But this just seemed like it was pandering to some kind of populace out there, to some ignorant fears that he's almost trying to flame.
Yeah, well, you know, members of the congressional delegation, the state's congressional delegation, are also, you know, debating this. So this is a whole, you know, huge issue. Senator Warren, not surprisingly, you know, said that we are not a nation that backs down in fear and we should not be putting any restrictions on Syrian refugees. Senator Ed Markey was a little more cautious. But, you know, Representative Lynch and Bill Keating, they voted to pass that bill that would make it harder for refugees from Syria and Iraq to enter the United States. So there are divisions, even among our congressional delegations. You can understand, I think, what would happen here with Governor Baker. Do you think he's the bad governor, Renee?
Oh, I don't know, you know, what's motivating him, really. I mean, as I said, I can understand the impulse to want to say something that feels like, you know, I want to try to have as a priority keeping Massachusetts residents safe. But And it's not entirely partisan because there are Democrats, as you mentioned, even in the Massachusetts delegation who have supported this this stance, but it's just, it is symbolic and it doesn't have any real effect. So let's stop, you know, talking about that and, you know, start, you know, focusing on what we can do that would keep Americans safe, perhaps.
And we also heard from Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on all of this, who we should say kind of changed his mind a little bit, because first he was saying he echoed Governor Baker's initial comments, and then he went back a little bit, citing the Commonwealth's history of what he said being collaborators on refugee resettlement. Let's listen.
I get asked several times, does this mean you want a ban? And I said, no. What I want is information. But until I have that information, I want to look out for the safety and security of the people of the Commonwealth of Mass.
We should say that was Governor Baker, not Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. That was Governor Baker talking about an outright ban, and Marty Walsh echoing those comments of the governor, talking about whether or not Syrian refugees should be allowed in Massachusetts and whether he would try to do anything about it. Marty Walsh going back and forth on this, Tom, what do you think?
Sounds like the Olympics.
Right, it does. I mean, it sounds exactly like the Olympics.
You know, I guess you always say it's give someone credit for being willing to change his or her mind. So I give him credit for being willing to change his mind. I would have hoped that that on issues like this, politicians would really think very carefully before giving voice, because the ability, you know, sort of the idea of creating stereotypes or bigotry is perhaps one of the most pernicious things we can do. And it's something I think that leaders really have an obligation to try to dampen those down and to try to get us to see people as individuals rather than as classes that we like or don't like. And I would hope that Marty may have learned from this experience and won't repeat it.
Totally agree.
Totally agree. Okay, good.
Well, let's turn now briefly to the issue of fantasy sports charter schools. Essentially, a very busy week for Attorney General Maura Healey. She's going to be on the show talking with Deb in just a couple minutes from now. But we thought we'd get both your takes on a couple quick issues that the AG has been involved in recently. Because yesterday she announced a proposal to regulate fantasy sports.
A prudent course forward for us is to take action today, immediate action, to promulgate these regulations. They are detailed, they are robust, and they will protect consumers here in this state.
So we've got a bunch of regulations for Maura Healey here. One would limit players younger than 21 from playing fantasy sports, prevent advertising on college campuses. She really laid out a bunch of regulations here instead of doing what New York did, which was outright say, no, we don't want this here. DraftKings actually praised Healey for her approach, releasing a statement saying, while we do have some concerns with the regulations, we intend to work closely with the Attorney General to ensure that we are operating in the best interest of our customers. Renee, what do you think? Did Maura Healey do the right thing, get the right balance here in terms of regulation and allowing these games to continue?
Yeah, well, of course, I think that these games ought to be regulated. I want to say that the concerns that DraftKings has about the regulations that have been proposed is that has to do with the age limit and with limiting the ability to play this on college campuses, which seems like an important kind of protective regulation, and those are the ones that they most disagree with. So where these companies, if they're so concerned about, you know, doing things fairly and evening the playing field and, you know, being responsible, where were they? Why didn't they self-regulate? Why did they have to wait until there were threats of lawsuits and bans and, you know, attorney generals getting involved before they were willing to talk about some sort of common sense regulations on this, you know, activity, which, you know, people can spend their money on whatever they want, but it's clearly gambling. It's, you know, the idea to call it a game of skill, you know, Scrabble is a game of skill, but if you bet on it, then it's gambling. I don't really see the distinction here.
But do any companies self-regulate? I mean, really, do any companies say, well, we're going to make sure that people don't get hurt by this and we're going to put all these regulations on ourselves and make sure that we're doing the right thing? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, that's what the tort system is for, right? That's how you self-regulate. So I think, Renee's, I mean, look, one of the things that happens here is as soon as you say, let's regulate, that means you're not banning. And that is the crucial distinction that's out here.
Which is why DraftKings was so
Which is
so
why
happy
DraftKings is thrilled about this whole thing. We could argue about 21 or 18, and maybe we'll have 20.5 as sort of the middle. But obviously, DraftKings is happy about this particular approach. Renee's right. It's gambling. Poker's gambling, too. And, you know, and it's a game of skill. But I think that the wrong way to take this on is to say, well, it's gambling, so we should ban it, because the only entity that's allowed to run gambling is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And, you know, again, if people want to spend their money, let them spend their money. Make sure that there's some sort of transparent system out there so they understand what they're spending their money on, what their real odds are, what's really going on in the game they're playing.
Let's touch upon something else that we're going to talk with the Attorney General about, and that's charter schools and this lawsuit over charter schools. Now, the Attorney General, who has to represent the state officials in this whole lawsuit over lifting the cap on charter schools, is also moving to crush the lawsuit that would lift the cap on charter schools. The governor supports lifting that cap on charter schools, as does the state education secretary. So I think the Attorney General finds herself in an interesting situation here. What do you think about this fight over the cap? Renee, let's start with you.
Well, you know, first of all, there's also an effort to put something on the ballot that would lift the cap. So there's a lot of pressure on the governor and the attorney general to try to get ahead of that. I tend to be a little softer than some of my super liberal friends on charter schools. I mean, I think they're an important choice that's offered to people, especially in lower performing districts. But I also think there's a deep irony here, which is that that the public school system needs to be better funded. And people may not remember this because this is how old I am. There used to be a lawsuit in Massachusetts called Webby versus King when Ed King was governor that then morphed into another different named suit, but which was the lawsuit that the parents brought very much in parallel to the lawsuit that these parents are now bringing to expand the charter school cap. this suit was brought to get the state to take a greater role in public in funding the public schools. You know, unfortunately, here in Massachusetts, birthplace of public education, we do not fund our schools properly. And, you know, so you end up with charter schools, which are really a symptom of the problem. The problem is that the public schools, whether they're charter schools or, you know, so-called traditional public schools, are not getting the resources they need to educate our kids. And you need to, unfortunately, go to lawsuits and so on to try to get redress.
Right. Tom?
So a quick disclaimer. I do work for a charter school company. It's a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. It runs some charter schools. It doesn't run any in Massachusetts, but I'm a fan of charter schools, and I really think they're very, very effective, particularly in communities and usually low-income communities where the public school system really has not been running effectively. So as a result, I would wish that the politicians in Massachusetts would be more willing to embrace new charter schools. Having said that, I think that Healy is sort of in a little bit of a rock and a hard place here because she is the chief law enforcement officer. So she has to defend existing law. And I think that may be what's going on.
Right. Well, in just the last minute or so that we have, I do want to pick up on one more topic, which actually, France aside, might have been the biggest story for a lot of our listeners.
I wish I can play another 40 years. So I have you guys behind me, but it doesn't work that way. And after next year, time is up. So let's enjoy next season.
David Ortiz, Big Poppy, turned 40 this week. He's saying that the next season is going to be his last and he's going to retire from baseball. Tom, how do you feel?
Time stops for no one. I don't think there's anyone alive who has seen the Red Sox be a championship team that has not had David Ortiz as part of it. And obviously, it's going to be a tough moment for everybody to see a passage occurring. The passage will occur successfully. I have to tell you, I give the guy amazing credit for being willing to say, hey, there's a time you should stop, and let's go out when I'm sort of at the top of my game.
On
rather
his birthday.
Than like so many people, like so many people who kind of, a lot of athletes just hang on and hang on when they shouldn't be hanging on, and their skills diminish, and they really aren't doing what they should be doing. He had a great year this year, the Red Sox notwithstanding. I think he will next year, and then he's gone, and it'll be terrific.
Hit his 500th home run, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So,
Renee?
He's all washed up at 40, right? 40. Wow. Yeah, you know, it took a long time for the Red Sox to win a World Series, and we have a lot to thank David Ortiz for that. So thank you, Big Poppy. I sort of was disappointed last year when he snookered the president into that sponsorship selfie.
Right. For Ka-ching,
baby.
Right.
That was sort of unfortunate. But, you know, it's a small mark on an otherwise brilliant career.
All right. Well, let's just take a moment to do our hubbubs, of course. And those are those little stories that may not have made it above the fold, as they say in the newspaper biz. So, Renee, what's your hubbub?
Well, the market in all things Trump continues to be bullish. The mop-topped mogul came out ahead in a recent WBUR poll ahead of his nearest rivals in New Hampshire. So it's no surprise that everyone is trying to capitalize on this hot trend. Recently, the real estate company Coldwell Banker sent out a press release announcing that Trump's first mansion, which is on a waterfront peninsula in Greenwich, Connecticut, is for sale. And they, you know, really hyped the fact that it was Trump and Ivana's home. Never mind that neither Trump nor his ex-wife have owned the house since 1998, this 19,000 square foot behemoth.
Oh,
but, you know, if you've got $54 million to spare, you too can own a piece of history, perhaps a home once owned by a man who could be, but disagreeing a little bit with my colleague here, Tom Keene, probably won't be a president.
Sold. I'm the cash buyer.
Nominee. I hope he's not president.
Wow. Okay. Tom, you're up.
It looks like the MBTA is going to put an end to the night owl service. And this is, of course, the experiment to see if we could have very, very late hours. Unfortunately, I think it's kind of inevitable. First of all, we really aren't New York. And at less than one-tenth of the population, we're never going to be. Secondly, it turns out that the service was costing a public subsidy of over $13 per ride. And quite frankly, I have a hard time understanding how taxpayers, you know, who are at home at bed or whatever, are subsidizing kids who are out, you know, drinking until all hours. So,
you're sounding a bit crotchety, Tom.
I'm sounding a bit crotchety. But I'll tell you the big thing here, and I think this is the most important thing that's changed, and that is that the rise of services like Lyft and Uber are really making a difference, that it is about as expensive to get home, and you can do so more quickly and more safely and more securely by simply calling an Uber or even an Uber pool at this point. And that's really what's making public transit at late hours unnecessary.
I have to say, I'm totally with you on that, Tom. I'm usually a very ferocious advocate of expanding T service, but this is one where I feel like there are better options out there, and the T should probably put its money elsewhere, like fixing stuff. So
winter time.
Yeah, winter, exactly.
Let's not think winter yet, although it is holiday time, so my hubbub has something to do with the holidays, because the Christmas tree arrived in Boston this morning, as you probably know, 49 feet tall from Nova Scotia. Now, I think you're a little bit, if I do a little quiz here and ask people, do they know why Nova Scotia gives Boston this tree every year?
An exploding boat.
Because we helped them at one point, and I don't know what we helped them with.
Some history thing.
Yeah, we helped them in an explosion in Halifax in 1917. That's right. So, and this year's tree actually was donated by a man who ran the Boston Marathon in 1996. Tree lighting ceremony, of course, will be held next week.
I love that story. I'm sorry I blurted it out. I like just flashed back to when I was in middle school. Just raise my hand. Pick me.
I know.
Sorry about that. Well, my hubbub, my hubbub is a really bittersweet one, and it has to do with the retirement of Joe. Oh my gosh, let me see if I can say his last name right. First of all, he worked, Joe Caluti. I'm not affluent enough to have had him make any pants or suits for me, but he is the tailor at Rizzo Tailors in Cambridge, and he'd been there for 40 years, and he closed up shop this week. And it had a wonderful story. I mean, it's the fantastic story of an immigrant coming to Massachusetts, making a life here, committing himself to a craft. He had you know, dozens, hundreds of, you know, very famous customers at his store, including the current Secretary of State, John Kerry. And it just so happens that he could not find anybody to take over the store for him, that there was nobody who was willing to, as the Globe put it, spend 40 hours in the fine craft of making a bespoke suit. And I have to say, I see a lot of hipsters out there who are crocheting and doing needlework, or, you know, the bearded ones who like to do woodwork. Why not tailoring? I'm serious. There's a beauty to committing yourself to a craft like that, and I'm sorry to see Rizzo Tailors close in Cambridge, but the end of yet another era in Boston. So that's my hubbub for today.
All right. Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe, writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Also, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a writer for Politico, WBUR's Cognoscenti page, and the Globe. Thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
Well, when we come back, Attorney General Maura Healey joins us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.